On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
This is the 79th anniversary of Operation Overlord, the largest invasion up till that time in world history that was so important that the designation that they use in the military for the day that something like this starts, D-Day, became synonymous with the Normandy invasion. To talk to us today, we have a distinguished American historian who combined with an English historian who was the son of one of the people that's talked about in this book. And so we are so very delighted to welcome Edward E. Gordon, professional historian, researcher, writer, speaker, taught history courses at DePaul University in Chicago and business subjects at Loyola University Chicago and Northwestern, a member of the American Historical Association, and was a participant in the Distinguished Lecturer Program of the Organization of American Historians. He is the author or co-author of 19 books and has written over 300 articles in journals and trade publications. His new book with David Ramsey is Divided on D-Day, How Leadership Failures Threaten the Normandy Invasion. It's from Prometheus Books, which is an imprint of Globe Pequot. Ed, thank you very much for joining us today on the Bookshelf.
You're very welcome, Dave. I'm happy to be here.
Let's lay down some structure for our listeners that an invasion like this took months and months and months of planning strategically, logistically, and practice-wise with the troops involved, with vast numbers of ships and tanks and human beings. How many people were involved in the Normandy invasion?
Well, the planning started more than a year beforehand and had been debated since, actually, just after Pearl Harbor, whether or not we would invade Europe first and treat that, or we would concentrate into the Japanese. But the number of personnel that were assembled in England to invade Europe were over 2 million men. And the initial invasion would try to put 150,000 soldiers on the shore of France the first day. It's very energetic, optimistic, and the planning was very minute.
The number of people involved in organizing this was enormous as well. The people that were involved, there were political ramifications because we have the Allies representing three nations at least, but also there are other nationalities, people that are in exile in England, such as the Poles and the Belgians, who are going to be involved in this as well. So we have a lot of political ramifications, and there seemed to be a very delicate balance about who's in charge of what.
That's right. You know, the British, remember, had been at war since September of 1939, and they had borne the brunt, in Western Europe at least, of the Nazi aggression, with the Russians now fighting for their lives against the Germans since June of 1941. So we were newcomers when Japan attacked. And remember, a lot of Americans really did not want to get America into what they thought the foreign wars in Europe until September 7th when the Japanese attacked, and then Hitler declared war on the United States on December 11th, which then settled the issue that we were in a world war. So the British assumed that they were in some way the senior partners, and they certainly had a very distinguished general staff. And they knew more about this, and we were the amateurs, they were the professionals. So they appointed initially a General Morgan, who is a Brit, to draw up the plans. And later, in 1942, Eisenhower arrived as a general. He had been on General Marshall's staff. General Marshall was the chief of staff of the Army here in the United States. And he was to assume command of the forces assembling in England that would ultimately invade France. And he worked with Morgan, and Morgan and Ike had a very good relationship. And ultimately, Overlord, which was the name of the code name for the invasion, would have a mixed staff of Brits and Americans who would work on the planning of Overlord. And that worked out very well. But then, when it came down to actually naming the commander-in-chief for the invasion, the supreme commander, Churchill had initially promised that role to the chief of staff of the British Armed Forces. And later, President Roosevelt had said that he thought, since the preponderance of forces would ultimately be American troops, that that should be something that was assigned to an American. And Eisenhower, as a result, beat out the British in command of the invasion itself. And that caused some real difficulties with the British. Alan Brooke was the field marshal who was in charge of the British Armed Forces. Montgomery had, of course, been the big hero of the Battle of Al Alamein, and Eisenhower felt rather insecure because he had really never commanded any military forces on a battlefield. And he asked initially that Montgomery would be the ground commander of all of the troops for the invasion itself. And later, he, Eisenhower, would take over. And so Montgomery was very happy about this because he had a very big ego. And later, and during actually most of the campaign itself, he worked very hard to sort of push Eisenhower aside as supreme commander and take over the entire invasion. So you see, it was very complicated, and a lot of egos and politics were involved between the Brits and the Americans.
Now, one of the things that I found really interesting is that your co-author is the son of Admiral Ramsay, who was really, and not just based on your book, but based on other books that I've read about D-Day, was one of the really enormously successful members of this team, who did an incredible job, never fought with anybody, never tried to pick a fight over who was in charge of what. He just did his job and did his job extraordinarily well. And thanks to him, much of the logistical planning of Operation Overlord belongs to Admiral Ramsay. So it was really interesting to get his sons on this book as well, I'm thinking.
Yes, because Admiral Bertram Ramsay died in a tragic airplane accident in January of 1945. He wasn't shot down. The plane took off and crashed in France on a way to a meeting with Montgomery. But Ramsay, when Churchill agreed to the evacuation at Dunkirk in 1940, it was Ramsay who pulled it off. He orchestrated that. And then when we invaded, both the U.S. and Britain invaded North Africa in 1942 in Operation Torch, it was Ramsay who helped plan the logistics, the naval part of the landing. Remember, these amphibious assaults really had never been done on any massive scale before the Second World War.
Right.
There were things in World War I like Gallipoli, but this was much bigger and much more complex. And that was successful. And then he also planned the invasion of Sicily in 1943, and then who was brought back to England to plan D-Day. And he wrote a plan called Operation Neptune. And Neptune was the orchestration of 7,000 naval vessels, battleships, landing craft, all the freighters with all the supplies that would land the troops and then support the invasion. People tend to forget that once you put an army ashore on an enemy shore like France, controlled by the Germans, how are you going to supply all those men with the food, the gasoline, the ammunition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And remember, they had no ports. They landed on beaches. And one of, in his Operation Neptune plan, he basically emphasized the importance of ultimately seizing a major port. And the one he really thought would be the most use was Antwerp, because it was a huge port, and it was closer to Germany to supply the Allies as they moved toward Germany to invade Germany. And he was right. Without Antwerp, the Allies found themselves at the end of 1944 stranded on the border of Germany because they ran out of gas after the Battle of the Bulge. They just sat there until Antwerp became functional.
Now, see, these are the kind of things that most of us don't think about when we see a movie or read a book about World War II. Just vast amounts of gasoline were required to keep these tanks going. Vast amounts of aviation fuel was required to keep these enormous numbers of airplanes flying. At D-Day, there was practically no German air activity at all, because by this time, after bombings day and night for over a year, dogfighting with German fighter pilots, the attrition rate had finally caught up to Germany, and there were hardly any airplanes left. But that didn't keep us from sending bombers over and so forth. All of these things need fuel. All of these people need food. They can't carry enough food with them or forage to feed an army this vast. How many men were involved? Because we kept coming in, of course. That was the idea.
Right,
we land
exactly.
On the beach, and we take the beach, and we move inland, and more guys come after that.
That's right. But remember this. In World War II, for every one soldier carrying a rifle, it took 10 people in support to keep them going. So you have a vast logistical force in England and on the ground behind the scenes. Hitting back to your idea of the air power, it was the P-51 Mustang that drove the German Luftwaffe fighter planes from the skies, because we had to have air superiority for the invasion, or the invasion would have failed. And it was the introduction of the P-51 at the end of 1943 into 1944 that guaranteed the success of D-Day. Now, all of these generals that were involved were certainly competent leaders, and we did win the war, remember.
Right.
So, and the invasion was successful. The point of Divided on D-Day is to show and talk about some of the controversies of why did it take 2 months for the Allies to break out of the bridgehead, which is the invasion area. It took them a very long time, whereas the plan that Montgomery drew up for the troops when they landed basically had them breaking out immediately, and it didn't happen. And a large part of that was because Montgomery failed to take the critical city of Caen, which is a road center in Normandy. If you ever go to Normandy, it's a very pretty area, and along the beaches are dense forests and trees called the bocage, or we call them, the Allied Americans call them hedgerows.
Right.
And it's a hell of a place to fight, because it's cut up with streams and bushes and trees. And the plan was to avoid that and to go through Caen and break onto a broad plain outside of Normandy, where the Allied superiority in tanks would make the difference. Because the Germans had actually better tanks than we did, bigger, stronger tanks. But for every Panzer they had, we had 100 Shermans. The Germans complained, you know, that they knock out all these German tanks, and yet another 1,000 would appear over the horizon. and of course, our air power was so strong that the Germans had terrible difficulties in bringing up reinforcements during the day to hold that front, which they held for 2 months. But Montgomery basically didn't do what he said he was going to do. Kept promising a breakout that did not occur. And finally the breakout did occur, and the Americans started it. He then failed to capitalize on the retreat of the Germans from Normandy into what was called the Falaise Pocket. The plan was for the Brits to come in from the north, and Patton, who was another big egocentric general, just like Montgomery, his forces would come up from the south, and they'd close at Falaise. and capture 200,000 Germans. Well, it didn't happen. And it didn't happen because Patton moved, and he could have closed the gap. But Montgomery's forces of Canadian Brits didn't close the gap from their end. And Patton was stopped by Eisenhower, Bradley, and Montgomery from closing that gap. Because of that, only 50,000 Germans were captured. The rest escaped. And those troops helped to fight in the Battle of the Bulge and hold the Americans back later in 44 and 45. The war could have ended much quicker, possibly in 1944, because with the capture of the German army of the Falaise Gap, there were very few German troops between the Allies, the German border, and Berlin. Very few. Most were on the Russian front. 75% of all the casualties by the Germans in World War II were on the Russian front. That gives you an idea of the size of that battle. I'm not, again, saying, well, Normandy and the West was nothing. No, but the bulk of the German army was on the Russian front, not in Western Europe. In August, September, we had that opportunity, and we blew it. So later, even after that, Patton, they took Paris. Patton was out 100 miles in front of Montgomery's forces, and there was nothing in front of Patton's southern thrust. He proposed to go through the West Wall, which was the German defenses, take the Saar, Frankfurt, and then go northward toward the Ruhr. The Ruhr is the industrial area of Germany. And without that, the Germans could not continue the war. The initial idea was Patton would come from the south, Montgomery would come from the north, and they would surround the Ruhr Valley and then go to Berlin. That was the plan that Eisenhower wanted. Well, Montgomery was far behind. And the difficulty, they didn't have enough gasoline. They had not taken the port of Antwerp. Montgomery finally took the city, but the islands in the Scheldt River blocked the Allied vessels from coming in because the Germans occupied those islands. So Montgomery convinced Eisenhower to give him all the gasoline, and Operation Market Garden, which was an operation with armor and paratroop divisions, would fight their way across Belgium and Holland and get into, cross the Rhine and take the Ruhr Valley. And Patton, they took away all his gasoline. He just sat there on the border with Germany. Well, we know what happened with Market Garden. It was a bridge too far. Didn't happen, did it? They did not break through. In fact, there were more casualties with Market Garden than with D-Day itself. Mm. It was a fiasco. And then they finally took Antwerp, but not till the end of 1944 in terms of the Scheldt Estuary and starting to import the supplies that they needed. And in the meantime, Hitler, in a desperate gamble, what did he do? The Arnhem, the Battle of the Bulge, right, which failed but caused tremendous U.S. casualties and further delayed the final invasion of the Germany itself and the war. So this book that David and I wrote, which took 10 years in the research, is an amalgamation of all of the material that has been published before. And our analysis then of these controversies. Why didn't they break out? Why was it took them 2 months to do that? Why didn't we close the Falaise Gap? Why wasn't Patton given the gas to break into Germany, and instead the fiasco of Market Garden was done instead? And in a Market Garden sense, the intelligence showed there were tremendous German forces on the ground where they were going to land those paratroopers. And Montgomery knew it, Eisenhower knew it, but they went ahead with the plan anyway, and it slaughtered the Poles. It wiped out the 1st British paratroop division. So these are very interesting issues. And what we've tried to present to the non-expert is a compelling narrative of the battles, some of the human interest stories, and answer some of these controversies. Also for the people that have read all the armchair historians of World War II, that have read everything,
Right.
And now we're trying to help settle that by looking at the papers of these men, the other research that have been uncovered by historians in the past, and pull it all together for you. But from a British-American perspective, this is the first time that a professional British and American historians together have written this book. So it's not pro-British or pro-American. We have plenty of criticism for all of these men and what they did right,
right.
and what they did wrong.
Yeah. Well, one of the guys that comes off as a big hero in this is Patton, flamboyant, shoots from the hip. Sometimes he shoots himself in the foot because of what he says or things that he does.
Yes.
But he is absolutely determined to win. And he when you're reading the section where he's pleading with them, give me the gasoline, and we'll be in Germany. You can only imagine his frustration.
Yes. Well, you know, he had done well in North Africa and Sicily. Bradley had been his deputy commander then. But Bradley did not appreciate his ego. And, of course, the slapping incident in Sicily was something that Bradley was abhorrent. And actually, Eisenhower came very close to sending him back to America. But he realized that Patton was a tremendous ground commander and really could move his troops. And he wanted him for Normandy. Patton should have been the commander of the American forces, not Bradley.
Yeah.
But they couldn't do it because of what Patton, the hornet's nest Patton had stirred up.
Yeah.
So they held him in reserve with the Third Army. He was not in D-Day, not till August 1st. Was the Third Army activated, and he took off. And we analyze here and give you a good understanding of why he was so successful. Yes, he was flamboyant. Yes, he was leading the charge. He was a very careful planner. His forces actually had very low casualty rates compared to some of the other commanders.
Right. Well,
because of the way in which he handled them.
You point out that some of the places that he fought were places that he and his wife had gone to in their honeymoon. So
yes.
he was not surprised by the Bocage. He was not surprised by this situation or that situation. He'd walk the grounds. He knew the territory. And
yes.
This is an absolutely critical kind of skill to have if you're going to drive tanks across places to know, okay, this place is very marshy normally, and the Germans are most likely, if I was them, I'd blow the bridges and flood this so we couldn't get tanks through there, and that's exactly the situation that they faced.
Well, the Germans admired Patton because he applied many of their concepts of the marrying of air power, tanks, and infantry to move forward in an American blitzkrieg across France. And so they really greatly admired him. He believed not in when he came to an obstacle of going around it and getting to the rear, like the Germans did in their offensives, and causing panic with the frontline troops then and getting them to retreat rather than head-on assaults against a defensive force. And that's exactly what Patton did. So, you know, the book explains, I think, in not excruciating detail, but in a way that everyone can understand. In all these military acronyms and concepts, what we do is we explain this very carefully so that you're not lost with it. And the maps in the book were all carefully drawn by us. We had professionals working with us so that when we tell you about a certain place, a river, or town, and we refer to a map, by golly, it's there. It's
yes.
on that map. So you can see for yourself, and there are pictures of these places and men throughout the book. So this is a very cogent and readable explanation of the book, of the Normandy invasion,
yeah.
of Operation Overlord, not just D-Day itself, June 6th, but it goes all the way through till around September and touches on some of what happened afterwards. And then at the end, we give you a little analysis of each man was in this command structure on the Allied side, Bradley, Ramsey, Tedder, who was a Brit, the deputy commander, Eisenhower, Montgomery, the air marshal, Lee Mallory, Patton, and Beadle Smith, who was Eisenhower's chief of staff. So it's a compelling story, it's a human story, and it's also a story about leadership. What went right, what went wrong.
Right. And interestingly enough for me, Eisenhower comes off as a guy who's always willing to learn. Even if he makes mistakes, he learns from every situation eventually. And maybe this is why, in the broader view, when he became president, he was the most quietly aggressive cold warrior of all the presidents, because he had finally figured out what you had to do to keep ahead of a determined and fierce enemy. So even though he made some significant mistakes as the supreme commander of Overlord, it seems like he learned from them.
Yeah.
Poor Montgomery.
He was the only man who could really do the job.
Yeah.
Because he was the arbitrator between the French, the British, the Americans, and the other national groups involved. So we don't want to run down Eisenhower as a failure. He was not. It did work. We could say it could have worked faster. The war could have ended sooner.
Yeah.
That's 500,000 casualties that would not have happened. We could have maybe, I think, gotten to Berlin before the Russians. A large part of eastern Germany we might have occupied, and parts of Czechoslovakia and other eastern countries. The Cold War would have been somewhat different than mm-hmm. what it was. Of course, there's always ifs, ands, buts, and maybes.
Right, right.
In history.
Yes.
And what we're basically just trying to show you is the strengths and weaknesses. In the end, Overlord was a stunning success. The Germans made more mistakes than we did. The biggest mistake was Adolf Hitler,
yeah.
who tried to minutely control that battle down to the regimental level, which was a disaster. It was a disaster in Russia. It was a disaster in Normandy. Rommel was a great commander, probably one of the most important commanders in the German army in World War II. And Patton comes out certainly as the best battlefield commander in World War II for the United States,
right.
in the Pacific or the European theater.
It is a fascinating book. The maps are a huge help in figuring out all of these places that they had to be at the time that they needed to be there and what stood between them and success. Ed, I want to thank you so much for writing this wonderful book with David Ramsey, and thank you for making time to talk to us today for the 79th anniversary of the D-Day landing in Normandy.
You're welcome. And I'll be doing a program in New Hampshire at a history museum on this book and at other museums and universities across the U.S.
Wonderful. We can probably find them on YouTube then eventually.
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent.
And if you're interested, look at our website, historypresentations, that's plural, .com, and you will see information about Divided on D-Day and many of the other 90 historical programs I have provided to groups across the entire United States.
Wow. Ed, it's been a great honor. Thank you so much for making time to talk to us today.
And thank you for having me on your program.
Our thanks to Ed Gordon, who, along with David Ramsey, are the authors of Divided on D-Day, How Leadership Failures Threatened the Normandy Invasion. It's from Prometheus Books. Ed holds PhDs in history and psychology. David Ramsey, who unfortunately died during the COVID pandemic after having a stroke, was the author of Lusitania Saga and Myth and Blinker Hall, Spymaster, the Man Who Brought America into World War I. His father was Admiral Sir Bertram Ramsey, one of the real heroes of the D-Day and Operation Overlord. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.